Well, good morning, everyone. Well, we've looked at that experience that John of the Cross had in that monastery, cell, prison. And it reminds us, of course, of Jesus on the cross, the, "My God, why have you abandoned me?" So he did feel in that time an utter sense of abandonment, and he was abandoned, but not by God. And he held on in faith in that dark place. "Where have you hidden, beloved?" So he still was able to say beloved, but he was asking about the lack of experience, really, of any consolation or love. And then last lecture or talk or presentation, we John of Ian Matthew took us to that very beautiful poem in which John of the Cross, a few years later, expresses his essential belief in the presence of the beloved. I've called this presentation, following Ian Matthew, "The Gospel Has Eyes." I think it's rather a beautiful expression. So John witnesses by experience and in his writing that God's real, and that the impact of God in our lives is a real thing. It's real. He encourages us to be brave, to dare to respond and the journey, and to believe, to be place ourselves in that love, to believe when we are in the dark. He knew darkness, and we have this echoed in his poetry. And John did something that we'll need to do too. John surrendered to the impact of God. We can move from wherever we are towards God through Jesus. As a number of times has been said, where we are is not the problem. It's our lack of courage or whatever it is that's stopping me take a next step of love from where I am. The gift is God himself in Jesus, who is sharing his spirit with us. Communion in the life of the Trinity, the life of God. So our desire, our longing, our journey is to let Jesus live in me and pray in me. Faith gives knowledge. There's different ways of acquiring knowledge, as you know, and the wonderful scientific world in which we live keeps exponentially exploding into more and more knowledge. We can even get people, you know, we can get to Mars, and we can just do astonishing things thanks to the human intelligence and the scientific method that we've learned to follow. But we all know that there are limits to what that wonderful gift to us that we're all involved in can bring us to. There are so many things that the logical mind can't pin down and develop from. Faith gives another kind of knowledge, a knowledge that needs to be checked, a knowledge that needs to be, we need to watch for the fruits, because we can believe very strange and foolish things if we're not careful. So it needs constant checking, but we know that faith, love, opens us up to experience which enables us to flower, really. So faith does give knowledge, the knowledge that can come only through love. recalling Jesus' words to the Samaritan woman, "The water that I give you will become for you a spring of water welling up to eternal life." John of the Cross, in stanza 12 of the spiritual canticle, compares faith to a spring. And then he says, this is John of the Cross's words, "If only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I so long for, which I bear sketched deep within my heart." I'll just say it again because it's so amazing. So he's seeing the silvered over face. It's like a lake, but there's something covering, and you see the reflection, but you somehow can't penetrate to the depth. There's something, and the silvered over face is the dogmas of the church, the teachings of the catechism, the rituals we go, everything really that we say. But under them there's something. If only on this silvered over face you, Jesus, would suddenly form the eyes I so long for, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. So we could all say that. You've made us for yourself, O God. Our heart is restless till it rests in you. We're all made for this. We all long for this. And we long that the eyes of the risen Christ would reveal themselves through all this faith life that we live. In commenting on these lines, John of the Cross states, "It seems that the beloved is now always looking at the one he loves." He might have picked it up from Teresa of Avila, or she from him, or they both independently came to it. Remember, Teresa of Avila says, "Look on him. He never takes his eyes off you." Well, here's John saying, it seems, we're beyond certainties here, but it seems that the beloved now is always looking at the one he loves. Later, in that same stanza, or in stanza 32 now, he writes, "When you looked at me, your eyes imprinted in me your gaze, your grace, so ardently did you love me." When you looked at me, your eyes imprinted in me your grace, so ardently did you love me. Ian Matthew paints this little picture which I find helpful, and you might too. He says to us, look, and this has happened to us all in different ways, imagine sitting on a quiet bench in the park between some flower beds and backed by a hedge. You're composing a quite personal letter. You're absorbed in your writing. Someone's there. You notice this out of the corner of your eye. Someone's there looking at you, and has been looking at you for quite some time. And then he makes the gospel has eyes, the eyes I long for, John calls them. And the point comes on the journey when the bride meets those eyes which had been long been looking on. The risen Christ has been present in our lives, but then we took it for granted, or we didn't notice it, and then you do. It seems to her that he's now always gazing on her, says John of the Cross. She finds herself a factor in another's life and heart. In the flame, says in Matthew, John has captured that moment and delivered it to us. In fact, it encompasses our whole existence. We sang yesterday, I won't play it again now, O living flame of love, tenderly wound my soul in its deepest inner heart without oppression. Come, consummate our love. Tear through the veil of our union. If it be your will, come and rend the veil of the temple. Pardon me butting across John, but you know that scene, the beautiful scene in the Synoptic Gospels where Jesus dies, and at his death, when he commends his life to God, the veil of the temple is torn asunder. Nothing to do with the temple down the road, everything to do with that veil which in their long, long, long tradition has hidden the face of God, because you can't look at God and live. When Jesus gave everything finally on the cross, gave his life to us and to his Father, that veil, symbolically, which was in the temple, the veil was torn, and at last we, looking on the one we've pierced, can see the face of God. That's what they're telling us by that symbolic, powerful metaphor. Well, here it is here. If it be your will, come, rend the veil of the temple. Remove whatever it is that's stopping me see you. Meet your eyes. And the poem goes on, O lamps of fire in deep caverns of feeling, once obscured and blind, are now leading in the warmth and the passion of your love. Yet, gently your hand does wound. Frequently John of the Cross is amazed about himself and of course others that he's with, that God's hurting, God's a touch when it wounds us is so gentle, but we can't cope with it. Gently your hand does wound as you rend through the veil of my temple. Come, take this life that I give so that I might come to live in this hour, in joining Jesus in his dying, in his love-giving, his life-giving. Back to our text from the Canticle. If only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I long for so, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. It's been said, says he in Matthew, that a person is enlightened not when they get an idea, but when someone looks at them. A person is enlightened when another person loves them. The eyes are the windows to the heart. They search the person out, and they have power to elicit life. Years ago, I read a book called The Agony and the Ecstasy about Michelangelo. You may well have read it. And I find it just such a powerful image. he's working in a workshop or yard in Florence, and in this yard next door or down the road a bit, there was a piece of stunning white Carrara marble that had been cut off the mountain, but when it was cut, it broke awkwardly and fell. So there it was, this high or whatever, but unshapely, broken, like it was one piece, but jagged and angled, and no one could do anything with it. Not even Michelangelo. He kind of sensed that there was something possible, but he couldn't get it. And I'm not a sculptor, of course, and you might be, and you'd understand. He kept looking at it, until one day he saw in the marble something. And then, as an artist, he would chip away till he revealed to me and you what he'd seen. And the product of all this was the most famous David, you know, one of the, if not the greatest bit of sculpture in the world, certainly right up there. And what I want to reflect on, which this says here, it's that look. I've seen it. I've seen mums and dads look at their babies like this, gazing. And I'm sure my parents must have done it to me. I can't remember it here, but I bet my whole body remembers it, and I bet yours does too. Those moments that have wasted time, those moments of looking, and then the baby, if you like, but not just the baby, husband, wife, people, friends. That look that a psychiatrist gives you when you have trouble and go and talk to him or her, I presume, when your spiritual director is giving it to you, yes, must be. That look that somehow reveals to me when I go, this look opens up stuff that I don't know about, and it comes because of the artist, the lover, the psychologist, the parent, the teacher, the priest, the sister working in whatever. This look of Michelangelo that doesn't pretend to know, knows I don't know, but waits and looks, and somehow that love enables something to come forth. Teachers know this. Well, the eyes, says he in Matthew, are windows on the heart. They search the person out, and they have power to elicit life. Wouldn't it be beautiful if we always looked at people like this? Jesus did. John of the Cross writes in his commentary on the Canticle, God's gaze works four blessings in the soul. It cleanses, because only any impurity shows itself up in the light of this look. It makes beautiful, it enriches, and it enlightens. It cleanses, makes beautiful, enriches and enlightens. The 32nd stanza of the Spiritual Canticle, you looked with love upon me, and deep within your eyes imprinted grace. This mercy, this is John's experience, so it can be ours. This mercy set me free, held in your love's embrace, to lift my eyes adoring to your face. You looked with love upon me, and deep within your eyes imprinted grace. This mercy set me free. Wouldn't we all like that? Held in your love's embrace, to lift my eyes adoring to your face, to believe you. and John of the Cross again in the flame of love. God is always like this. As the soul now sees God to be, stimulating, guiding, giving being and strength and graces and gifts to all creatures, holding them all in God's self. One of John of the Cross's sayings, the Father spoke one word who was his Son. And this word God is always speaking in eternal silence. It is in silence that we must hear it. The created world, says Ian Matthew, answers that he did pass this way, clothing whatever he looked at in beauty. The searching, where have you hidden? Creation responds. Oh yes, says this beautiful creation around us here. Yes, yes, pouring out 1,000 graces, he did pass these groves in haste. And having looked at them, with his image alone, he clothed them in beauty. So creation shows the look of the Creator. Second, the Son is God's, the Son, Jesus, is God's face smiling upon the world. The proper response to God's offer is trusting belief. As we said a lot earlier, John actually said this. We know some of his experiences, but he actually said it. He believed it. He showed it's true and real, and it's helped people for 500 years ever since dare to believe that their journey is real too. Trusting belief, and this engages our native desire. In the first place, says John of the Cross, you should realize that if you're seeking God, and you all are because you're here, you've gone on retreat, if you're seeking God, much more is your beloved seeking you. Again, John of the Cross, desire with all your soul's desire to come to what in this life lies beyond your mind or the capacity of your heart. Dare to believe it and desire it. John's experience, says Ian Matthew of the Spirit, was not valued because it was felt. This has to be important, doesn't it? It wasn't valued because it was felt. It was valued because it was real. And he could trust its reality even when he couldn't feel it. Where God is concerned, writes Ian, the problem lies in our desiring too little. Growing means expanding our expectations, or rather, making God's generosity, not our poverty, the measure of our expectations. Enter within your heart, says John of the Cross, and work in the presence of your bridegroom who's always present, loving you. And John of the Cross, in his flame commentary, says, "Awaken us, my Lord, and shed your light upon us, that we might recognize and come to love the blessings that you always hold out to us. And we shall realize that you stepped forward to show us your favor, and you have not forgotten us." 9 months in that cell, which he keeps going back to, and that's why we are. Terrible, utter thing. But he knew that God believed, knew in faith that God had not forgotten him. And then the fruit showed later. Here we have an extraordinary piece of literature from the Gospel of John, chapter 14, within about 4 or 5 verses. We have this remarkable statement of Jesus in the 14th chapter, just the Last Supper discourse. "If you love me," said Jesus, "you'll keep my commandments." The word "command" is a bit tricky in English because, as with every word, it takes on the colour of its use. So it's important to know that the word "command" in English derives from an earlier English word, which is the word "commend." Put an E instead of the A. So in its original intention, a command was something you entrusted to someone to do. You commended it to them. So here Jesus, the Last Supper, isn't commanding them in our funny broken sense. You can't command love. But he's desperate, not desperate, he's commending something to them. Because there's plenty of women at wells, and there's plenty of blind people, and there's plenty of thieves dying on crosses, and there's plenty of thirsty, hungry, blind, lame people around in different aspects. So he can't do it anymore. So he says, "Look, I can't sit at wells anymore, but you can, Thomas, and you can, Philip, and you can, Nathaniel. So I'm commending it to you. Love one another as I've loved you. Do with my love. Keep doing it for me, please." So back, "If you love me, well, you'll do what I'm entrusting to you. And I'll ask the Father, and he'll give you another advocate to be with you forever. This is the Spirit of truth." And truth in John's Gospel always and only means who God really is. It's not a syllogism come to a right conclusion. That's important, but it's not the point made here. The Spirit of truth is the Spirit that continues to reveal the real God. "The Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him," him's a bit difficult, but allow it for a minute. "You know the Spirit, because the Spirit abides with you and will be in you." Now, it may be a bit fanciful, it probably is, but I imagine Jesus at the Last Supper saying that to them. You know, I'm going, but I'll send my Spirit. And I can imagine all the apostles looking a bit glum. All this talk about the Spirit's very nice, but, you know, they're not going to be fobbed off kind of thing. And so Jesus says, "Oh, all right," he says, "I won't leave you orphan, I'm coming to you." Oh, well, okay, good, so they can relax. So it's the Spirit, but it's, they want him, you know, they want something, you know. "I'm coming to you. And in case that's not enough, look at the rest of it. if you love me, you'll keep my word. You know, the keep of a castle, the inner bit that they might get across the moat and they may break through the wall and they may hack soldiers to bits, but they can't get into the keep because it's a tight, and the only entrance is up there and you've got to have a ladder to get there, etc. So it's the keep, the bit that you can't get to. Keep my word, and my Father will love you. And we will come to you and make our home in you. This is, I don't know what I'm about to say, but I think this is at the source of all Christian mysticism, really. This is, well, there we're being told of the indwelling God. And so that in, you're asked to believe, I'm asked to believe, we want to believe, that in here, in your heart, soul, body, person, Jesus is loving his Father. You're a temple of the Holy Spirit. Do you not know you're a temple of God, says Paul? So you're the keep. And inside you, deep down in the well of your being, Jesus is loving his Father. The Father is loving Jesus. And the love communion between them, which is intimately and utterly personal, is that spirit, that breath of love. And that's all going on inside us, whatever we're doing. What a pity not to know about it, and what a pity not to take time to witness it and be there while it's happening. This is the mystery of the indwelling God. I have to ask you a question because I can't remember. Did I look at that with you? I did already. Thank you. I thought I had. That beautiful. I'll just read it to you. Look at his eyes again and let him say to you, come to me, all you that labour and are heavily burdened, and I'll give you rest. Learn from me, because I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your soul. Let's just go now to the Gospels. The Gospel has eyes. And I just want to go through with you one particular person, a beautiful person in the Gospel called Peter, and watch Jesus watching him and imagine what's going on between them. Luke's Gospel, they all have the calling of the disciples, but Luke's the only one with this scene. It's really quite gorgeous. They're out there, Jesus gets into the boat, and because there's crowds and everything, and then he sees this, and he says to Peter, it's in the morning, he says, look, would you go out and fish? And Peter says, look, I've been fishing all night, didn't catch anything, but okay, or if you want to live, okay, right, I'm sure. So he gets his mates, and they go out, and they catch all these fish. And Peter then comes in, falls at Jesus' feet, as it were, and he's very attracted by Jesus, but he knows who he is. He's just had a hell of a barney with his wife, probably, back, you know, the mother-in-law, or maybe the mother-in-law, anyhow, whatever. Something's gone on at home, who knows, and there's all this muck around going on. And he says, depart from me. He says, look, Jesus, look, you get something else. I mean, you're wasting your time. I'm a sinful man. Doesn't seem to bother Jesus, his being a sinful man, because Jesus knows something we've all got to learn. The only thing to do with someone who's sinful like me or you is to love us out of it, not condemn us in it. So Jesus just loves him. And it doesn't quite get out of it, because people will keep sinning, bits of whatever. But there's the first encounter we look at the supper. Strange kind of encounter, because Peter says there for supper, with great love, and that's a good thing. He says to Peter, look, they might all, the rest of them might chuff off, he said, but I'm going to die with you if it comes to that. So he really means it. It comes straight from his heart, and he absolutely intends it. Whatever happens to Jesus, he'll be there. then comes the tricky bit. Peter's, it's all gone pear-shaped. Jesus is actually being tried and bashed up, and Peter's there. He wants to be close, but how close can you get? And he sneaks into the courtyard because one of his mates knows whoever. And he's in there, and this maid says, "Hey, this Galilean speaker here." And he says, no, you've got the wrong man. I don't know him. Who are you talking about? And what gets worse, then he calls on oath. In God's name, he declares it. And then comes this extraordinary, lovely little line. It's only in Luke, but don't miss it. It said Jesus, he's just been tried and he's been carted through the courtyard to the next bit. And it says, Jesus looked at Peter, comma, and Peter went out and wept bitterly. So just stay with that for a minute. Imagine that look. Jesus doesn't muck around, so he must have looked. In the look must have been a lot of hurt, a lot of abandonment. Even his closest friend that he entrusting things with couldn't help him. So there's a bit, there's loneliness in it, I suppose. There's all that, but there's immense love, must be, because Peter just feels the love. And for the rest of Peter's life, he never forgot he denied Jesus. How could you? And he didn't. And the others didn't let him anyhow, because they were going to remind him, "Hey, hang on, you. Remember, and if you got it, yeah." So, but he what he used to remember was the sin, yes, but the sin and the forgiven sin, the look, which must have had an immense amount of love in it. And that colours everything. It doesn't excuse the sin, but it helps you learn from it. In the resurrection encounter, we don't hear much about that, but when these chaps come back from Emmaus, and they're all excited and bewildered and all the rest of it, and they tell them how he walked, some of this stranger was with them, and how their hearts were burning, and they had a sit down to supper, they didn't actually see him, because as soon as they saw him, he vanished. Like, they didn't see him with ease, but they encountered the risen Christ. They raced back to Jerusalem. Isn't that a good idea? And that's why Luke writes it that way. We're not supposed to have our little private experiences out there and keep them that way, because they could go anywhere. No, we're supposed to bring our experiences back to the body, to the community, to everyone, to be discerned too. And they said, "It's true." That must have been a great feeling for them. It's true. And why was it true? Because he's appeared to Simon. And then comes chapter 21. And this amazing practical love scene between Jesus and Peter. You know the rest of the scene, I'll take it as read. But Peter's there and Jesus says to him, "Oh, Pete." "Yes," says Peter. He said, "Look, Peter, do you love me more than the others?" God, they must have gone in, because the word he uses for love is agapan. Agape is the noun, and agapao is the verb. So he's actually not asking him about anything. He's asking him, agape means, "Can I actually trust you?" At the Last Supper, Peter said, "I do love you more than the others." And Jesus is checking, "Do you?" And thank God Peter's learned a bit of humility in the meantime. And he realises he doesn't. He's not more than anybody. But Jesus asks him, "Do you love me?" Agape. "Can I trust you? Can I commit my friends to you? Can you strengthen your brothers and sisters now? Can you do that?" And Peter, it doesn't come across in your English text, but Peter doesn't answer Jesus' question. He can't, because he sinned yesterday. Well, what's to say he's not going to sin tomorrow? Who knows whether he's trustworthy or not? Peter certainly doesn't know that he is. And of himself, of course, he's not. So he says to Jesus, "I love you." But he doesn't say agapao, he says phileo. "Beautiful, I'm your friend, I feel for you. I want to be with you, I love you," in our ordinary English sense. It's a beautiful answer. And Jesus says, seems pretty good to you. So he says, feed my lambs. Look after the little ones. Because love's really important with the little ones, of course. Then Jesus asks the second question. And then you've got to get in the middle of all this and feel it. He says, do you love me? And he drops out the rest because Pete's learnt humility. He's not going to. Do you love me? And it is, again, agapao. Do you, can I actually trust you now, Peter? And once again, Peter doesn't answer. He says, I love you. But he makes a different word, phileo. I'm your friend. And so on. And the third time, beautifully, Jesus shifts. And this is why Peter's so hurt by the third one. Jesus says, Peter, do you love me? And he uses phileo this time. Are you really my friend? Do you actually care for me? Will you spend time with me? Do you trust me? All that stuff that goes on between friends. And Peter breaks down. Because the third time Jesus changes the question, he says, oh, look, don't ask me that. I don't mind you asking me whether I'm trustworthy or not, because I don't think I am. But don't check, don't question my love. You know everything. You know I love you, phileo. Feed my sheep. That extraordinary encounter of where Peter was able to, what would be a good way to put it, able to kind of make, not make up for, but say love where he had said, I don't know him. So it's a beautiful way of Jesus kind of around the side re-establishing their relationship. In Matthew writes, God's gaze is God's love. And God's love does things. God's gaze works four blessings in the soul, and here he's quoting John of the Cross, we had it earlier. It cleanses, it makes beautiful, it enriches and enlightens. So I hope you can, you do what you're called to do, or drawn to do by God, but maybe today you could all dare to believe that the risen Christ is gazing on you. Is prayer possible now for me, we might ask. And here's John's contribution. Christ's loving gaze is constantly upon us, and it's that gaze that makes prayer possible. First letter of Peter, chapter 1. Although you've not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him. You put yourself in his love, trustingly. And rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy, for you are receiving the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your soul. The life that you experience in your deepest inner being, your soul, is enlivened, enriched, purified. The Gospels, and I conclude here, the Gospels are portraits of Jesus. I think you know by now, don't you? Maybe as young years ago, we used to read the Gospels almost like flipping through a photo album. And we kind of, I don't know, thought or were taught or just presumed that everything that's there is factual. And a lot of it is, of course, that we're watching what Jesus actually said and what Jesus actually did, and everything that we read about actually happened, could have been videoed, had we had videos in those days. That might be the way we do it, the way you flip through a photo album. We've come to see, of course, everyone at their time saw, and all through the medieval period they saw it without realising it because they didn't have our distinctions, but they took it all as iconic and big and drama and music and ordinary human stuff, but we've become so intellectual or something, or we've learnt methods of study that are really important, and we've locked everything in there, or could have. Now we know that going through the Gospels is like going through an art gallery. And you're watching, as we're told, from the highest level of the Vatican, we're told that, no, the Gospels are about what Jesus said and did, but they also include interpretive commentary. Because we've got to put ourselves in the position of all these Gospel icon writers in words, and they're thinking, how can I communicate to the people in Thessalonica who speak Greek, how can I communicate them the meaning of what Jesus said and did? So they, as any historian would do, they pile in all this wonderful, dramatic, poetic, musical material. So the Gospels are portraits of Jesus. We're not only seeing, we're being taken right into the inner meaning, which only a Gospel can do. Jesus knew God in the love communion that sustained and directed him. That's how he knew God. Being man, he knew God in faith. That is to say, he chose to believe. It's a choice. And he made that choice. He chose to believe. And because he was faithful to that choice, he, Jesus, came to experience the communion for which he, Jesus, longed. Jesus knew that real life consists in this communion, and so he invited all the people of the Gospel, blind, lame, deaf, broken, sinners, Pharisees, high priests, Pilate, soldiers, everybody. He invited them as best he could to join in this communion with him. And John of the Cross knew that. All the saints know it. You all know it. He knew it and he was faithful to it. And we're being given through him his simple human experience, but expressed by an artist of words that can somehow get to our soul. The Gospel has eyes. When Jesus proclaimed, "I've come that you may live and live to the full." So everyone in this room, we must all believe that what the only thing Jesus wants is for us, each of us, to live to the full and together to live to the full. He was giving expression to his longing to share with us his prayer communion with God.